Welcome to another episode of New Books in Poetry. I'm your host, John Ebersol, and I'm delighted to be joined by the poet Joshua Edwards. His new book is titled Imperial Nostalgias, Ugly Duckling Press, 2013, and the title hints at a longing for a lost world all of us helped to either destroy or at the very least forgot. While tipping his hat to the social sciences throughout the book, Imperial Nostalgias is cunningly personal. Each page is an intimate window to look out of, a window to take siesta in, a window to shout from, to lean beyond, but never a window to leap from, because his poems don't harass one into annihilation. Instead, they are oddly charming and innocent, perhaps a counterforce to what his eye must behold. Most of his poems are like a game of tag between imagery and aphorism, between abstraction and the concrete, which is the direct result of a person devoted to travel, which Imperial Nostalgia seems a direct outcome of. In fact, when I finished the book, I felt like I hadn't talked to another person in weeks, as if sitting alone on a long train ride, as the subjects of his poems flash by as history, literary and otherwise, until the moment the landscape bleeds into the candor of personal meditation. The poet's voice reflects the plain vernacular of talking to oneself, that most humble act, which simultaneously making the same voice sound as if it desires to be heard by all. Imperial Nostalgias is the labor of a multitasking poet, and the book reflects this in its restless pursuits. Not only do we discover poetry in the book, but strange photographs and severe fragments of language also join us on the journey of reading. And not only are these vagrant, busy pieces made strange by being collected as one, but the book itself, this binded object, worked equally strange on me as a reader. Because of its modest size, I found myself preferring to carry the book in my back pocket all the time, and since inside the book several empty panels of paper exist, I found myself drawing and writing inside Imperial Nostalgias. And by doing so, the book became an amicable traveling companion. It is in this experience where I discovered Joshua Edwards' generosity as an artist. While his work made solitude uncomfortably palpable for me, at some mysterious point I discovered the poet was with me the entire time I thought I was alone. Joshua Edwards, welcome to New Books in Poetry.
Hello, John. Thank you.
You're welcome. Before we get into your really amazing book here, I thought we could kind of turn back the clock and get a sense of your biography. Can you tell us where you were born and raised and kind of grew up?
Yeah, I was born in Galveston, Texas, an island off the coast, about 30-something miles from Houston. And I lived there until I was five, at which point my family moved up the coast about 25 miles kind of to a place between Galveston and Houston called Clear Lake Shores, which is another island, sort of a very small island that's just abutted with the mainland. But yeah, so I grew up there, coastal Texas, still got a lot of Texas pride despite everything. And yeah, I lived there until I was 17, at which point I left, and I really didn't go back for more than a few months until recently, when my wife and I decided to move back there. But in between there, I've lived all over the U.S. I forget how many states. I lived in Philly, where you are, for a little while.
Excellent.
Worked at the PMA. I lived in Alabama. I lived in Michigan. I lived in Oregon, Washington, California, New York for a couple months. A lot of places. And then a bunch of different countries. I spent A good part of my young adulthood, working in Latin America for, during the summers for a nonprofit, like public health and youth leadership organization called Amigos de las Americas. So yeah, I spent a lot of time in Mexico and then a few months in Nicaragua, Ecuador, Dominican Republic. So, and I studied there, and then I did a Fulbright in Mexico. And then, where else? I guess Lynn and I have also lived. We lived in China for a year. Now we're in Germany. We were in Mexico together for a year. So, yeah, I guess the itinerancy that came through in your wonderfully eloquent appreciation of the book is, it's definitely been kind of central to my life.
That hearing all those places is a bit overwhelming to someone who hasn't traveled nearly as much.
Yeah.
So to be honest, it does come off as, I don't want to say excessive because that has a negative connotation, but it seems generous to say the least. What do you think has propelled you, and not even maybe.
Well, yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm running from something, right?
I wasn't even going there.
The dark recesses of my soul. No, I don't know. I mean, part of it, I think, you know, going to Mexico when I was 16 for, I think the first time, I mean, I had gone to Mexico because I grew up in Texas. I went to Mexico with family whenever we would go to New Mexico on vacations. We would stop in Mexico and El Paso. But I think going to Mexico when I was 16 was like a huge sort of revelation for me, not just because of the people that I met who lived in Mexico, but also the people who I met who traveled there on the same project that I did, who were living all around the States. And that kind of got me thinking like, I wanted to get out of Texas. And once I started traveling, just it seems like, you know, I just kept going different places. I mean, I also followed, you know, sort of relationships a few places. On what else? Yeah, I guess, yeah, it's always been that. Carlos Fuentes said something about, you know, in sort of being dislocated or being in new cultures, that experience is sort of like a mirror for oneself. And so it's always been tied to my writing. I started to become interested in writing poetry when I was in Mexico the second time. It started as a way for me to sort of process my feelings about, you know, identity and politics and just the world in general. So I think, yeah, they've always been pretty tied. So I guess that's what kind of propels both things forward is like this, this sort of snake eating its tail. It's like I write because I want to discover myself, and then I go somewhere so I can find something else I need to discover or something like that.
No, I totally, I really like what you said about that it reflects back to you. One thing, it made me think of the poet Andre Cole once told me that when he would go to Japan, that one of the most pleasurable things he liked to do was ride the subways because he didn't understand a single word going on around him.
Oh yeah.
And for him, that he said that gave him a great interior freedom, and he felt really like at home in his own skin, not having the burden of maybe being surrounded by a language he understood or being, I don't know. So in fact, it's funny because the cliche is like, oh, you're running from something, when in fact, this kind of excessive travel might be exactly the opposite, in that it's even a more kind of honest way of discovering oneself. And then I was going to ask you precisely where did poetry fit in, and that it came kind of during your time as a teenager, right, in Mexico, that kind of was where it came about. How did your family react to all of this traveling? Is it something they were accustomed to, or were they like, oh my gosh, look at our son, he's freaking out on the globe?
Yeah, no, you know, my parents have always been super supportive of, I mean, my dad's a photographer, and my mom is a librarian and teacher, And they were, she was also a photographer when I was growing up. And they didn't travel a whole lot. In fact, both of my parents are coming to visit Lynn and I here in Germany in, just, I guess, a few weeks. And it will be my dad's first time
to
come to Europe. My mom's been a couple times, but, they're not, you know, they're not big travelers except for the road trips I would take as a kid. I think, you know, they've always thought it was really cool. And they were the reason why, you know, they introduced me to the idea of going to Mexico on this project whenever I was 16. And
yeah, it's really fantastic actually that they were, kind of nudged you into that direction. I know a lot of parents that would be fearful to do that.
No, they've always been really supportive of everything. And I think, you know, I try to do my best to go back home as much as possible. So I think that's probably made it a bit easier on them. If I had just like went and stayed away, I think it would probably be, they would be less supportive, but, and now that I'm moving to Texas, you know, I'll see a lot of them. So
that is great. Now, you know, most of the poets I've interviewed, in fact, I think nearly all of them have had experience or contact with the MFA program. Tell me just briefly about your kind of path through academia. Has it been, has your relationship with the university been in, you know, one of a lot of contact or just, what was that all about?
Yeah, you know, I definitely. I mean, it in the end, it has. Although it seems like I tried to resist, school for a long time. I was at University of Oregon as an undergrad. I was there for a year. So I knew I wanted to get out of Texas, and I was there for a year. And after that year, I knew that I wasn't really ready to, you know, go to school. Like, It was sort of, it was fine and well to get like B's and C's and classes, but, not really study. I thought, you know, I wanted to do something more interesting and, for me. And so after my freshman year, I dropped out and, I thought I was going to go maybe to Mexico and maybe do school in Mexico, because at that time my Spanish was like pretty good, and I thought, well, I want to go ahead and push it and, you know, and really challenge myself with language and just choose a different route. But what I did instead was a friend of mine, this guy Ian, he was moving to we were in the Dominican Republic, and he was moving to Boston to do like, I think he was a bit older than me, and I met him in Mexico some years before, and he was always kind of, I still do look up to him. And he was like, hey man, you should, you know, if you don't want to go to school next year, you should move to Boston with me. Like, it's like, it's like where it's at. I guess this was like, I don't know if he's telling me the truth. This is like 1997 or so. He's like, yeah, you know, Boston's where it's at. And he's also always traveled a lot. He went to school in a couple places and, you know, lived in South America and all over Latin America. And so I was like, okay, I'll move to, I'll move to Boston. I guess I left Boston out on my initial list, but, I moved to Boston and, so I lived there for about 5 or 6 months. I worked at a Super Salad on Federal and Franklin.
And, how romantic.
You know, yeah. And, you know, it was like, it was really great. I mean, we lived in Roxbury in this like, really kind of nasty apartment. We lived in two really nasty apartments, and I could do a whole podcast on the sorrow of this first place we lived in. I won't go on about it too much, except to say that, it was a pretty dire, place to live. But so I lived there and I worked at Super Salad, and, it was good because I worked with a a lot of people who spoke Spanish, and, you know, I got to speak Spanish at work. And, I made enough. I worked overtime a lot. And so I would save all my money. And then I think after like 5 or 7 months, I had this like little box, like a cigar box that I taped shut and cut a hole in the top. And I would just stuff money in that thing.
That's awesome.
And, yeah, so then I, at the end of my time, I opened it up and I had whatever. I had somehow managed to save like more, like a couple $1,000 or something crazy for somebody who's worth making $7.50 an hour. But, yeah, so then I went on a trip. I went to Europe to see some friends. It's my first trip to Europe. I went to Denmark and Sweden. And then, I ended up coming back to the States. I moved back to Oregon. I didn't go to school yet. I got a job. And then I spent kind of a year. I worked in a super, in a Schlotzky's there, Delhi. And it became obvious to me after, you know, working in these fast food places, for like a year or whatever, that, it would be good to go back to school, or to, you know, go ahead and make the move to going to school abroad or something. And I decided, well, actually then I ended up in a relationship after I went to Ecuador for a summer, and then I ended up in a relationship with this woman who was like my, one of my best friends, and I moved to Kansas City. And,
that's where love always goes.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. So, and then when I was in Kansas City, I started taking some, I again worked at, another, food service job in, Einstein's Bagels.
Sure.
In Roland Park. I did have a car, so I had to walk to work. And then I took a couple of classes because it was like in-state tuition if you took less than, you know, 8 hours. So I took a philosophy class and then maybe like a, I forget, language class or something. Something I figured I would need if I went back to school. Yeah. And then, that, you know, that ended and I went south there. I forget exactly what happened, but basically it was clear that like we were too young to be playing house or whatever. And, cause I guess I was like 20 or something. And now that I think of it, it just all seems crazy, but, and then I went back to Oregon and I found that I could take classes, first of all, I discovered I could take these tests. I think it's called like the CLEP exam or CLEP exams, CLEMP. And they would give me credits. So I went in and I took as many of these tests as I could. And, it got me like a lot of credits for toward school, which I thought was insane because I would have had to pay all this money to go to school. But instead I took these exams for like $100 or something. I didn't have to take like, you know, any of my sophomore year and like half of my junior year. So, which was good because at that point, I mean, I was out of state in Oregon and, you know, I didn't really have any money left for school. So, I took these tests and then I took classes in the summer when there was also in-state tuition. And I think I took out some loans for my final year, but yeah, I ended up finishing, you know, school with just about like 2.5 years of, and I studied abroad because that was, and I went to Mexico to study abroad because that was also like in-state tuition.
Yeah.
And so after I finished, I was like, oh, this is great. Like, I'm going to stay out of school as much as humanly possible. Like, and then, you know, I ended up like going to grad school for a few years and then I ended up at Stanford for the Stegner Fellowship. And so I've been like totally, I feel like institutionalized and I've been, you know, I've loved, all my experience in school. But I've also like somehow tried to maintain this like delusion that, you know, my spirit is somehow like not academic or whatever, but yeah. And here I am at like this place that has Academy in the title. Right. I'm at the Academy Schloss Solitude. So yeah, I've definitely been nurtured at the bosom of academies and institutions.
Well, it doesn't sound like more than most people, however. And I'm really sympathetic, actually, to the idea of the poet or the artist really resisting academia for just a multitude of reasons. The most obvious one is just probably the kind of regimented kind of physical maze, just the classrooms, whatever.
Yeah.
But also that a lot of quality people are housed in academia, so there's that conundrum of, I don't actually want to be officially a member of you, but I want the kind of artistic social experience of interacting with it without parting with truckloads of money, you know?
Right.
Sounds like you really navigated that in a really healthy way, and I actually very much applaud you. So, fast forwarding, tell me about kind of the genesis of your first book of poems and how that came about.
My first book, Campeche, it's weird because a lot of the poems that are in the new book, Imperial Nostalgias, were written before Campeche book.
Interesting, yeah.
I don't know how many, but, you know, a significant number. But I think whenever I look back on sort of putting it together, it seems that at some point in time, just the idea of, like, of what I wanted a book to be came to me, and I started to – and it was sort of simultaneous to my apprehension of, like, what I – discovered I thought I was doing in my work, you know? And so I started to go through my poems and find the obsessions.
Yeah.
And I started to organize that first book around, sort of the ideas of the ocean and weather and, things like this. And, you know, having been from an island, these things were always on my mind, especially as, you know, there's an awful sort of hurricane tragedy every, it seems like, 3 to 5 years now. And that affected the neighborhood I grew up in and, you know, the island where I was born. So that was sort of how it came together. I guess just I started a group poems around this idea and then think about like how one goes about ordering and how also I could fit in poems that weren't necessarily in line with the rest, but would make sense in the context of a book and add texture. You know, for me, it's kind of interesting the place when the book breaks from its platform or its, you know, sort of proposition or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And how do you, what year was that published?
That was 2011.
And so that's relatively recent. How do you look back on it now? Do you still feel a great connection with it, or do you see yourself differently now than you did then as a poet and maybe even as a person?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm one of those people who always, is very much interested in what's going on right now, you know? And so I feel like once a poem is written, like the process is like a huge part of it for me and a book object. But I still feel connected to it, especially the object. And because it has my dad's photographs in it, that was a huge thing for me. Was whenever Noemi Peraski published it, you know, they offered to publish it. It was right at the moment they offered to publish it before I had sort of conceived of it with my father's photographs.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and so I was just sort of thinking about putting the poems with his photographs, I had started it right before they got in touch with me and let me know that they wanted to publish it. And, you know, they were really great about doing it with the photos. So,
that's great.
For me, I'm still really, it's that collaborative aspect that has continued to, really influenced my work since then, and the idea of having photographs and poems and fragments and things together. Because I guess I'm not really interested in the poem, like as a whatever, as a poem. I'm interested in you know, how it sets into motion the ideas that are inside of it. And you know, you can obviously, there's lots of different ways of getting to these ideas. So
yeah, no, that gets me thinking too about, and you talked, I think, about attention that that I feel anyway, is that I would characterize, it sounds like you and maybe someone like me and many others, that there's a social impulse within us, and that the idea of collaboration is a very exciting one. And yet being kind of a poet, this kind of solitary kind of, you know, kind of activity, that there's a struggle going on there. And I think it sounds like you're trying to say, hey, you know, like, yeah, I don't have to be this isolated figure scribbling away poems, that it can be kind of pathways to collaboration. I think that's really refreshing, because then, like you said, it has implications on the book as an object and where poetry can rest, and also what poetry can be a catalyst for. Real quick, what was it like, briefly, what was it like collaborating with your father? That sounds extraordinary.
Yeah, it was great. You know, the photographs that I used were mostly taken when I was like a young child in Galveston, between that, you know, 1978 and 1981. A few were from later, but a lot of them were from this project he did called the Galveston Seawall Project. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, you know, it was kind of a trip. A lot of these photographs I had sort of lived with for my whole life, having seen them, and they were iconic for me. You know, whenever I would sort of think of images for poems, a lot of my dad's photographs would sort of come to mind. So yeah, that ability to sort of, you know, reach back into, you know, the sort of foundational images of my imagination was really great. And he was, you know, he's just a really laid back and great person. And also his, you know, it would be hard to imagine working with anybody who has like more knowledge of art and ideas than he does. I mean, he's just one of these people who just knows about everything. And so, yeah, the process of putting the poems with the photographs, I mean, he left it pretty much all up to me. We talked about, you know, the photographs and him taking them a lot. So, it was great.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Let's start kind of turning our gaze to Imperial Nostalgias. Can you tell me real quick how the book came together and how your relationship with and your experience with Ugly Duckling Press went?
Yeah. Well, let's see. The book came together because I had a bunch of poems sitting around, and and I guess I started to look at them, and Lynn and I had been living in China, and so I was writing some poems that sort of came out of my experience there. Sort of going back to that, the sort of sensation of having an ambient language, which is for one ambient. Yeah. You know, a lot of the poems were spurred along by this sort of new experience with language, and language is not just Mandarin, but also Shanghainese, and like trying to figure out, you know, how one can go about learning a language in a place where, you know, two distinct dialects are being spoken, and right, sort of getting confused in your head. And I, you know, my Chinese is basically nil. But But I was teaching at an English language school, so I was in touch, you know, with a lot of Chinese speakers all the time, and we would do exercises when that would bring up sort of the relationships between words and Chinese and how sort of puns worked and
that's great.
Things like that. So that became sort of like a central to me thinking about like how I wanted to make a book. And mm-hmm. then Lennon, before we were in China, we had spent a year in Mexico. So I went back over the poems that I had written in Mexico. And then I thought about, you know, how these things connected. And then I found some other poems I had written like while traveling in grad school, at University of Michigan. And, so I just kind of looked at everything and I was like, oh wow, these, you know, I'm starting to see how this stuff goes together. And I wrote some new things and then I found some really old, like the last section, the fugitive pieces. Those were like really, really like some of the first poems I wrote. When I was in Nicaragua and,
it's interesting to think about the poems, I don't know why, but I always, it's just interesting how they kind of travel across time like that to end up as a collection, that they don't have to be like composed in a certain time period, that they're talking back to one another from different time periods.
Yeah.
Really great. And what was your experience with Ugly Duckling Press, when you started working with them?
It was amazing. I mean, I had sent in, my manuscript. I think I sent it to two places at first, you know, I was like, okay, I'm just going to, there's no rush to like get a book out, so I'm just going to send it to Ugly Duckling and another place. And and when they took it, I was just like blown away because I love the physical object.
Yeah, they're special press.
They do. Yeah, so it was great. I mean, I couldn't have been happier. You know, they designed the book. Matve designed the book and. They used one of my friend John's photographs.
Yeah, it's a startling photograph.
I didn't have any of my own photographs that I thought would like work on the cover.
Yeah.
I had used one of his photographs for the cover of this journal that I edited.
Mm-hmm.
The guy's name's John Alexander.
Excellent, John Alexander.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. I found it terrifying at first to look at the cover.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, wow, that's how I feel most mornings when I wake up. I was like, thanks a lot for calling me out like that. But, let's get into the book. Yeah. It's a remarkable book. And you started off with two parables. And do you want to say anything about the parables, why you started the book off this way, before you read them?
I think they just sort of, I think they kind of speak for themselves. I mean, as far as like why they come in the beginning.
Definitely.
So yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
So I'll read those.
All right.
All right. Two parables. The traveler. After traveling for many days, the man arrived in the town square and sat down with his legs under him. He spoke and a crowd gathered. He said that the kingdom smelled good and was strong, but that evil was more powerful than ever and had only ducked down out of sight. The crowd listened, jerking forward and buzzing like a swarm of bees. The man said the people thought of pleasure as their final state, and he called this belief profane. They looked him over. He had a face like a doctor from another country, and they could tell he had spent his life in perpetual hunger. They knew that he could see through the pain that enclosed their lives, like an animal without any mind. They sat and watched and listened as he issued severe and careful restrictions and spoke, as if reading from a scroll, the names of their most precious ancestors. When he was done speaking, he rose and left town, continuing down the same road he arrived on. The Outsider. In the dog days, an outsider stuck the reel up into the imaginary while standing on a stage, backlit by fireworks. Then his body seemed to dissect itself, and at first this display of magic erased the crowd's worst memories of the recent evenings that ruined their city. But then it seemed as if nobody had heard of the imagination, And after their initial surprise, the people yelled out against the fraudulent showman, saying they would use brute force, threatening to cut his throat. Yelled back at them, healing requires, nay, demands a falsification of perspective. I am more real when I sleep than you people are when you're awake. This did not sit well with the crowd. Horror, disgust, and then bloodlust filled them, and they surged forward to take hold of the magician. But just as they reached him, he disappeared in a cloud of smoke, leaving behind a note that read, "The next disaster is just around the corner."
Thanks, Josh. I found these I found these so remarkable. And I, the first thing that jumped out at me about them was the clear relationship between this kind of individual on display, on display to the crowd, which I think is, you know, kind of a nod to the tradition of the parable. And, but that the crowd is, very, is behaving very interesting. Especially if I, real quick turn to the outsider, that the crowd seems appalled at the idea of using their imagination or seeing somebody who, apparently has devoted their time and energy to the imagination. Right. And I do think a lot of parables, lend themselves, to being acted upon by the reader. So I definitely hesitate to interpret them in any concrete way, but I can only speak for myself when the crowd in that, really spoke to me in the sense that, that we live in kind of, a culture or a world that demands fact and utility, and that the magician was so appalling to them because he, the magician was suggesting that there's another type of knowledge perhaps available to the crowd, and that that knowledge available to the crowd was so disruptive to the crowd that it caused them to want to perpetrate violence on this person. And, it was really remarkable. It really spoke to some things I wrestle with. And same thing with the traveler, that when the individual reads from the scroll to the crowd the names of their most precious ancestors, I can only assume that that scroll is being read because the crowd has utterly forgotten their most precious ancestors. And it seemed to me that the parable was suggesting that we have kind of a, or at least this crowd has somehow abandoned the past for more immediate concerns, and which I think the book wrestles with often is that immediate concern, at least what is sold to us anyway as something sublime, and that is just pure pleasure, that somehow this has been elevated as a transcendent goal. But that was really remarkable.
Oh, thanks. I mean, yeah, that's a terrific reading. And, you know, I think, yeah, you've definitely thought about them more than I've tried to keep my relationship to most of the things in here.
Yeah.
Sort of, rather, you know, in the realm of sort of my own negative capability. And
no, but, I think that's exactly right. I think that's one of the book's generosities. I think at one point, and it's a poem we'll look at later, you do mention something when you're talking about language as a sense of, like, that, in fact, there's a lot of mystery and drama in it. And that I'm highly sympathetic to. That is something I tried to – I experienced, and I think I circled in that poem, which I promise we'll get to, is the word feel was in it, and elevating the idea of the kind of phenomenological experience of, like, hey, there, we don't have to break everything knowledge down to these kind of ambitious experiments, that the poet or the artist can be the primary source, and that can be trusted in a highly technological scientific world.
Right.
But anyway, let's move on to the little section of photography in here. Can you tell me about the photography in here? I can tell you how I responded to them, and I wrote little I kind of just wrote notes under every one, and so we have a picture of a close-up of a traveler's back and the backpack has a series of tiny little kind of whimsical skulls lined in rows and columns with eyes as hearts.
Yeah.
And I just thought, traveler marked by fate. And then there's this disturbing, it looks like almost a Mexican wrestler's mask,
yeah,
lying in dirt. And it just like, I started really recklessly reading into these instead of just maybe taking a more Elizabeth Bishop kind of approach and just saying like, hey, just there's a physical thing, encounter it and move on.
Right, right.
You know, I started writing down things like social mask ripped.
It's
like,
nice.
But then I was like, wait, it's just a wrestling, you know, sometimes it's, right, it's just a stick.
Right, right.
So can you tell me about the photography? Why you, what,
yeah,
did you do?
So yeah, these are, photographs that I took in Oaxaca. I think almost all of them are from, except for one, were from, the time that when Lynn and I lived there, and also, from the summer before. And then there's one photograph, the one of the, I think, the dog and the little rat, which I took, I think I took when I was, like, living there when I was 16 or 17, or maybe it was, like, when I was there when I was, like, in my early 20s or something. I forget, but it was in this, that's one of my favorite photos that I've ever taken, because it was just, like, that was one of those things etched into my mind. And it was actually, I think, this photograph of the dog and the sort of rat. Unfortunately, I don't have a high fidelity version of it anymore, but I kind of liked that it was like the only sort of blurry kind of photo in here. But
I put under it emaciated science fiction.
Oh, nice. Yeah, it's sort of post-apocalyptic image.
Yeah.
But this was the image that made me want to put photographs in the,
yeah,
book. Because I have been carrying it around for so long in my mind. And then whenever I looked back at these photographs that I had taken, it's like, oh, yeah, a lot of them would, I think, really work with what I want to do with the book. And one of the things that we did when Lynn and I were living there was we went on and part of my proposal for the Fulbright also was to go on a walk between the archaeological sites of Mitla and Monte Alban, which are like, I don't know, they're probably like almost maybe 50 miles, 40 mm-hmm. something miles from each other. So we went on this really great walk for 2 days. And that also formed a basis of, I think, like the Mexican wrestler's mask. And let's see, there's a photograph of a little like house, and then there's a fire, and then there's the one of the there's a face of a politician, which is sort of halfway destroyed on a telephone pole. So those we took kind of in Mitla, and then along the walk, maybe three quarters of the way, you come to this tree called El Tule, which is like the largest tree in the world.
It's enormous. So,
yeah, and then get to the end and there's Monte Alban, but these aren't in like the order of the walk or anything.
Sure.
But yeah, that was a really nice part of our time in Mexico, was like doing this walk and then like kind of thinking about these things.
Definitely. And it kind of leaves us as a reader right into the section of the book called Departures, which you are going to read several sections of. Can you tell me about Departures, especially maybe the way you constructed them, because they appear in the book as, you know, kind of a sextet or like kind of these six-line stanzas,
yeah,
separated by an asterisk, and they're very regimented in their kind of visual appearance on the page, and they're untitled. Can you just tell us a little about that before you read the ones you're going to read?
For sure, yeah. They went through several different incarnations as far as the form. I forget what they used to be, like how many, maybe they were in like 10 line sections and then I kind of remixed them or something.
Yeah.
They also used to be a little more regimented as far as they were in syllabics, I think. And then I threw that out. And then I decided it would make it feel more episodic and more like travel if they were broken down into these six line stanzas, which sometimes are discrete and sometimes are integrated into like the ideas of what was before or after then. So
yeah, that's a really successful section. So yeah, if you can read some of those, that'd be great.
Sure. All right. I'll begin with the second one. Such as, if travel is an enemy to ends, why do they share so many smells and arrangements? Here there are no belts of daffodils, just crowds trapped in margins of stale air on this anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's assassination. The ride gets too rough for my weary eyes, so instead of reading, I daydream. My name is starting to seem too serious. I try to remember what it felt like to be accompanied by someone else en route somewhere in a nowhere like here. I have formulated a new type of resistance against my own ignorance. I transplant my mind a few times a day, replacing it with unreliable algorithms aimed at solving problems known as poems. I call them departures. I must admit I don't understand nature or how an author can insert it into a creed, but I know nothing about gardens or decomposition. If hello is the forest and goodbye is the field, then where is superego? Today I woke up with a floating thought. Undermining one's own authority is the new black. Maybe that means something, probably not. Last night I had a dream about death and mourning and a speedboat. I strained to make the connection with love.
Josh, thanks a lot. That was great.
Thank you.
There's so many little gems in here. The voice in here reminds me of, I mean, for me, it was the voice of travel, and that we don't, there's nothing high diction about the internal monologue.
Right.
That really brought the departures to this real intimacy and modesty that at first I didn't immediately respond to, because they seem so private. Mm-hmm. And then when I got through the book is when I realized they were extraordinarily open and generous to the reader. Were they kind of composed? They do feel like little journal entries or little haikus almost, or like they don't seem massively grand, but they seem grand in their modesty. Can you kind of talk about their composition?
Oh yeah, thanks. That's so between my first and second years when I was at University of Michigan, I got like a travel grant. I got one to go to Mexico, and I also got this thing to travel around the U.S. And so, I bought one of these Amtrak train passes, and I had done this before back when I was reading a lot of Kenneth Rexroth and Jack Kerouac and stuff like that. And so I knew that being on a train and going on these long trips alone could be generative for me as a writer. So I got this pass, and originally they had been, like I said, they were in different forms, and I dated each one. And I think I was on the road for like, or on the tracks or whatever for like a month. I had nothing else to do but read and write. Mm-hmm. And I would stop in places where I had friends, and that's also a big part of why I travel, is because, you know, when I was 16 and originally I made all these friends who lived in all these places. So I would want to go visit them, but they lived all these places. So I would have to like go on this kind of crazy road trip, but I never had a car. So it would usually be by train or bus. And that just really fed into my sort of desire to go further, go abroad and whatnot. So yeah, that was a part of it. I'd stop and visit friends, and then, you know, between seeing these people and having conversations with friends I hadn't perhaps seen in a long time, I'd have all these things going on in my head, and I'd have book recommendations. And so I would just, I would just basically write these, journal entries, which I tried to make poems as best I could. And, they didn't really seem like they fit anywhere until I started to think about this book. And I was like, well, you know, there needs to be a traveler at the center of it, you know, and also show a sort of a consciousness that is both sort of innocent and self-aware.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of these poems were written, you know, perhaps I've lost a bit of my innocence and gained a bit more self-awareness. But I think these, you know, these poems were written in at a time when that was when I was like kind of I guess more open to certain vulnerabilities in poems, and
right.
You know, I probably wouldn't feel like I was able to write these poems again.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was glad to be able to put that consciousness in with the other things.
So. I think that's great to hear, because I did read some of the lines, and I was like, I thought of them in the context of the contemporary moment in poetry, and I thought to myself, like, oh my God, how did you just get away with that? Like, because they're very, like you said, innocent. They're kind of just stripped down of artifice and just very humane. And I think,
thanks.
And it's sad when, one's humanity seems like a novelty in contemporary poetics, but
right,
I hope that's not entirely true. But you did bring up something interesting, and that is about friends. And I think it can lead into the next poem I'd like you to read, and that is Guest on page 59.
Oh, yeah. All right. Guests. I welcome my friends. They visit in the winter to get warm, or to be somewhere new, or to escape from someone or something that happened. I'm glad to play host, to show them the common pleasures of a place. We invoke old questions about home. We discuss relationships. We walk. We celebrate landscape, deride technology, and try to keep other foreigners out of our photographs, except for the ones meant to show how much stranger than us other foreigners must be.
Thanks, Josh. One thing I want to talk about, the role of friendship in your work and even in your life. I think it's a clear feature, the camaraderie of friendship. And it seems that some of the writers you've mentioned also share that in common with you. But something that did jump out, particularly in this section of the book, were two words, and we had briefly mentioned those things about a poet's obsessions.
Mm-hmm.
And the two words that came up were often common and foreign.
Mm,
and
yeah.
I was wondering how you, I think foreign seemed pretty straightforward, but for me, common was less clear how you just as an individual kind of conceive of that word. Is it simply communal camaraderie? It seemed to have, I don't know, it kept appearing in. And the last time I brought this up to a poet, when I pointed out words they often use, they were like, you jerk. You know, like,
yeah,
I don't know.
So
I'm not expecting you to, like, you know, break it down completely for us. But
you've definitely guaranteed that I'll never use either of those words again.
Oh.
But no, that's it's much appreciated. And it's I am really interested in the word common, now that I think of it. I didn't, you know, I knew a cup, maybe that place where it was in the book is always in my head. I don't know. I mean, I think, oh gosh, common. I wish I were one of those like people who could be like, well, the etymological root of common, you know, leads us to.
Yeah. You don't go there. I could read, here's a line from Science Versus Luck, which we're not going to get to today, but on page 51,
okay.
I feel like I'm interrogating you now. So,
no, this is great.
Specters are haunting a fair afternoon in the common ruin.
Yeah.
You know, this idea of the common ruin, you know, I guess it's used as an adjective often, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I wonder if common generally kind of just denotes that something consistent. I think the way you seem to use it anyways, or if we think of a common tongue or even a commonplace book, you know, there's something I think very nurturing about the word, or at least that speaks to human community in some
way. No, you know, I've never actually thought about the word, but I did, you know, when I was living in Boston, I would walk home every night. If I was working late, I would have to walk home, and I would walk often. I'd go out of my way to work, to walk through the Boston
Commons. I know where you're going, the Boston Commons, sure.
And so, you know, maybe that word has sort of lodged itself in my mind because it's an actual place. And I think, you know, places stay with us more than ideas. But
Well, I think it's really, unfair of me to do this to the poets. But I think it's interesting. I always do enjoy kind of pointing out their obsessions because I know I have mine. It's like, you know, how many times can you describe something decaying? Or why does that empty ball cap always show up in your poems? But anyway, just to drive this home later in that poem, is unbelief in a common language rolls back the wheel of history. So I don't want to belabor it, but I think for the reader, though, I think it does show. And I think it brings to light kind of somewhat of a project you have going on here, maybe unconsciously. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of just the tension between the individual and simply that individual happens to be fixed in human history. And I don't want to belabor it. In fact, I want to get to the poem that your book shares the title with, and that is Imperial Nostalgias.
Okay, so Imperial Nostalgias. They tried to prove through enterprise and art that a journey's end exists at the outset as a darkened lamp that tumbles back through all the stages of its building into a dream of light.
Yeah, that's really just really beautiful. And that first line really jumps out at me. I'm not sure who they are, but the verb tried, you know, they tried to prove suggests that that task might have been a little dubious, to say the least. And this idea of the lamp tumbling back through all the stages of its building to get to the idea of light is really beautiful. Now, Imperial Nostalgias, why do you think you decided to title the book this?
I stole it from... I stole it from one of my betters. It's the title of a suite of poems by Vallejo, and I'm much indebted to Latin American poets, especially Huidobro, Vallejo, and Neruda. You know, so so I think. It worked two ways for me because, first of all, it created a way for me to, I came up with the title for the book and then gave the title to that poem or wrote the poem after that title. I knew I wanted to sort of expose, a certain position of my own. I mean, you know, this, I'm a American, U.S. American poet, traveling all over the place, able to, you know, I mean, you can't get much more privileged than having a Fulbright fellowship and living in, Oaxaca as far as the relief that privilege takes on when you're in a situation where you don't have to work and you're allowed to like write poems and like go on long walks and stuff like that. So, you know, I am very conflicted about at times about the amount of leisure that I've had, you know, just thanks to these, you know, I feel like I've always like worked hard, but it's like, come on, like it's totally, you know, everything that I'm able to do is made possible by, where I'm from and, these institutions that have supported me. So, yeah, I mean, that's a poetry. I feel like is a, you know, it has that sort of, the imprint of nostalgia as far as like the, you know, the ability to do it or to, as not do it, obviously not write, but the ability to like sort of do it as like a profession, or if it can be thought of as a profession, or to live off of it, I guess is what I'm trying to say, you know? Yeah, it's always struck me as like such an incredible and yet troubling thing that, you know, some people can go through the world and with such, comfort.
No, I think, you encapsulate something so many of us, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, to the point of keeping you up at night, like, you know, whether I won this kind of lottery in life just by virtue of my geography.
Yeah.
How does one wrestle with that when there's clear suffering going on all around?
Right, right.
And, you know, and, but I think that one has to simply accept that and then decide what will be the quality of my wrestling with that circumstance.
Right.
And so I think there's no easy answer to that, and that each individual, especially artists, poets in America, have to wrestle with, you know?
Yeah.
And meanwhile, living in a culture that shoves in our face distractions all the time. That doesn't want us to worry about those things. So that's troubling as well. I want to kind of move us along to Monte Alban. And if you could talk about that poem a little bit. You mentioned it earlier as the archaeological site. Talk about it a little. Anything you want to say about it before you read it?
Yeah, I won't go on Wikipedia or anything. But, you know, Monte Alban is like sort of the ancient Zapotec civilization, like site of their civilization, or you know, now Zapotec cultures and spread out all over the place. But this was like where everything was kind of focused, like the capital, I guess. And it kind of overlooks the city of Oaxaca, and it's just a really remarkable place. And you know, I've gone there dozens of times, I think, since I was 16, and it's always sort of occupied this huge spot in my imagination. So, I'll read it.
Sure.
Monte Alban. 1. On this high ledge, it seems history's indeterminate plans and resolutions compete for what little space is left in the graveyard. When I was young, civilization seemed the most accurate word to describe my surroundings. Many years later, I learned about World War II, Albert Speer, and the phantasmagoria of the theory of ruin value. It broke my spirit. Now, surrounded by pyramids in a valley bereft of panthers, still disappointed in people and gods, alone with 1,000 years of silence, I think of Kenneth Patchen fighting with pain for the occupation of his mind as he writes, "This is my life, Caesar. I think it is good to live." 2. Through a turnstile, past a diorama of ruins, into the ruins themselves. Ruins as diorama, ruins as sculpture, birds as music boxes. Everything moves toward metaphor and dream. All the plants have wilted back home, where dust collects on bookshelves and covers catalogs, atlases, and old travel guides. I squint to define the sun in its place above platforms and tombs. The imaginary unknown makes me laugh like an idiot as I see my life as a museum visit at the end of a long vacation. I have lost my way and now call disorientation paradise.
Josh, thank you so much. It's really a remarkable poem. Unfortunately, our time is up, but I encourage every single human being who listens to this to go out and get a copy of Joshua Edwards's Imperial Nostalgias by Ugly Duckling Press, 2013. It's a book that I carry it around in my back pocket often, and it reminded me, it took me right back to my youthful exuberance as a reader, that it was a time when solitude didn't make me panic, and your book allowed me to experience that again. Josh, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, John. It's great, and thanks everyone who listened to this.
Excellent.